Senate Bill 59. Start a public hearing on Senate Bill 59. And
hi.
Good morning. My name is Erin Olson. I am forfeiture counsel for Multnomah County. I have participated in the meetings that the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee has held on legislative issues that have come up in the execution of the forfeiture legislation from 2001. The bill today that's before you is simply a correction to the legislation, I guess, to make the provisions internally consistent with respect to how long forfeiture counsel has to bring a forfeiture action. Right now, Section 6 of the legislation requires that the seizing agency decide within 30 days of seizure for criminal forfeiture whether to seek forfeiture, but Section 8 requires that an indictment or information be filed within 15 days after seizure for criminal forfeiture. So we're simply making the 30-day timeline consistent within the legislation. It was not a particularly controversial issue, and there was a consensus that the correction needed to be made, and
okay.
So I ask for your support.
I don't see that the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association signed up, so ACLU or any of the other usual suspects. So.
Thank you.
All right, any questions of this one? There are none. Work session, Senate Bill 59.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
Got here in the nick of time to move this bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 59 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
I'm just going to say calendar.
And then Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 59 to the floor of the Senate as, with a due pass recommendation unamended as part of the consent calendar.
Yes,
is there any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none. So thank you very much. And that was quick, wasn't it?
Carrier
will be Senator Walker. Okay. I give one to Charlie Ringo, though.
I would be glad to take this one as long as I don't have to take one later.
No, it doesn't work that way, Senator Ringo.
Senator Walker.
I was willing.
Mr. Callahan is here. Okay, so we'll start then. Public hearing on Senate Bill 65. Is that correct? No, I'm sorry. Senate Bill 52. I'm sorry.
Mr. Callister, if you know that one.
Ooh, I have a note in there file from somebody on the
Senator Minnis.
Can you just state your name for the record? You've done this a few times.
Well, members of the committee, my name is Pat Callahan. I'm a senior deputy district attorney with the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I'm here this morning not so much representing the District Attorney's Office of Multnomah County as a group which was put together originally through the Department of Motor Vehicles. That's called the Identity Theft Task Force. This is a group which started in about May of last year when confronted with the continuing and burgeoning problems presented by the crime of identity theft in this state and across the country. That group has been meeting throughout the summer and continues to meet, and it broke into numerous working parts, including victims' assistance, prosecution, and prevention. One of the outgrowths of the prosecution subcommittee and adopted by the entire task force is the concept that is embodied here in Senate Bill 52. Now, let me first, as a caveat, tell you that the Oregon Identity Theft Task Force has no legal brief. It has no constitution. It is rather a group of concerned citizens from law enforcement, from commerce, from banks, from the credit bureaus, from the Department of Motor Vehicles, from concerned administrative agencies, the Attorney General's Office, the U.S. Attorney's Office. It's a cross-section of groups upon all of whom identity theft has had an impact, including victims. One of the early principles that came out of that was the thought that there needed to be a more serious way of treating the most serious offenders, those identity thieves who are repeat offenders, who are the most egregious offenders, those who have the large enterprise that victimizes individuals and businesses within our community. Senate Bill 52 is an outgrowth of that concern. It tracks, in essence, it is the same phraseology, if you will, the same model that follows the existing aggravated theft statute, which was adopted by the legislature some 15 years ago when myself and others appeared in front of a committee much like this one to inform you that we needed a way to treat the most serious offenders in a more serious fashion. That's the growth of Senate Bill 52. It aims at capturing only the most serious of the identity thieves. You can see that the way that it is set up, it was intended to capture those who commit 10 or more instances of identity theft or who have prior convictions for identity theft, or the impact of their identity theft, the economic impact exceeds $10,000. The second portion of the bill makes the prosecution of identity theft and forgery a bit easier in each jurisdiction by allowing, as the committee is well aware, thieves know no county boundaries. And if your identity is stolen in Marion County, it may be used in Linn County or Lane County or Multnomah County. The second section of the bill puts identity theft and forgery on the same footing with theft, which allows, when cases are aggregated, put together, added together, in one county, that county will have jurisdiction over all of those offenses which are aggregated, even those which happen in another county. I'm happy to respond to questions. This is the unanimous feeling of the Identity Theft Task Force that the state of Oregon needs a serious law like this to deal with the most serious identity theft offenders.
Mr. Callahan, you prosecute these kind of cases, identity theft cases?
Yes, Senator Miss, I do.
Any idea how many defendants or possible prosecutions you might be engaged in under the statutory structure as well?
Senator Minnis, members of the committee, I spoke with Phil Lemon about that to try and get some sort of number, and I know he has talked with deputy DAs from other counties. But I would indicate to Senator Minnis that I think that this would be used sparingly and only in the most serious cases. There are currently laws on the books which allow us, for certain repeat offenders, to treat them as repeat property offenders and give them a sanction, albeit a modest one, in the state institution. This statute would enable law enforcement to go after the most serious offenders and to raise the stakes.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Reno.
Thank you. I don't really understand how identity theft works, and I'd appreciate it if you could just tell me one or two instances of people stealing credit card files from a business. I mean, give me some examples of how it gets going.
Senator, members of the committee, there are myriad ways a person may commit identity theft. The most common starts with a simple mail theft, where mailboxes, especially rural mailboxes, are hit and your mail is harvested. Now, within that mail are any number of documents which have important personal information. Now, it may not be your driver's license, it may not be your Social Security card, but it often will be your checks, whether you're sending them out to pay your utility bill. Those checks can then be used with your personal identification, your identity, Senator, your account number. Those checks can be washed, they can be counterfeited, and they can be then converted to the use of the criminal.
What is the definition of identity theft?
Well, the statute is a broad statute. It basically is anyone who possesses or uses the personal identification of another with the intent to defraud. And personal identification is given a inclusive definition. It includes a written document or electronic data which provides a person's name, address, number of a financial institution, employer identification number, Social Security card.
Yes, go ahead.
So the act of stealing somebody's mail is not identity theft?
It is mail theft.
Right, okay. It becomes identity theft when you use the credit cards or the checks.
It would become an identity theft if law enforcement were able to prove that the person was then possessing the personal identification of another, that is, that information, with an intent to defraud. Typically, it's not going to gel into an identity theft until that identity resurfaces at your local store, at the bank, in North Carolina, over the internet.
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead, sir.
I as I look at the amendments, the Section 1 sub B, a person has two or more previous convictions and yet commits another instance of identity theft seems to me entirely appropriate. This person hasn't learned their lesson, and so they need to be dealt with seriously. Sub A, though, says 10 or more times within 180 days, and I'm wondering whether somebody could go on a quick spree, a low dollar amount, I don't know, they've stolen somebody's identity to get into Blockbuster Video. Are there instances where there are somebody could run afoul of sub A, but in a way that is more of a juvenile on a minor spree than a the most serious type of offense as you're describing?
Senator Ringo, members of the committee, that is possible. I think that in a situation like that, the discretion of the district attorney who's charged with the prosecution of that crime would come into play. Is it possible that such a thing could happen? Yes. Although we would hope that once a person, many times you will realize that you're a victim of an identity thief. Another common way I wanted to get to it, another example, is to have your car broken into. Anymore, it used to be that the most typical target of a person breaking into a car was your stereo or any change that you've left inside the car. Anymore, that's a secondary target. The target now is identity. The target is your wallet, your purse, your credit cards, your account numbers, which are then hurriedly converted and used often before you're even aware of the fact that it's been compromised. In such a case, you're oftentimes alerted to that as soon as you check your car the next day, you check your mail and you see that you didn't get it, or your creditors call you and your bill that you paid didn't get to them. you report it, and then hopefully law enforcement can run that down. 10 incidents, we discussed this in the task force of whether it should be 5, whether 10 was too many. It was our judgment that 10 seemed to capture it, only the most serious of those. The other thing you have to understand, Senator, is the ability of law enforcement to actually track and for a prosecution to actually be mounted in each of those 10 incidents, for us to actually find out about those, have the police investigate, and be able to capture those within the camera.
That's better. But there could be examples where they were all done together at the same time and would add up to 10. I mean, maybe even with the same victim. I'm just looking for hypotheticals here.
Senator, I'm not sure that I can think of an instance where it would be done at the same time. If a person stole 10 people's mail and was caught with it as they were driving away and made the statement to law enforcement, I intended to use those, I possessed those with the intent to defraud, which would be rare for a criminal to say that, Senator. But I don't believe that that would, frankly, fit the definition as we are talking about it here, because that's simply one incident in which he possessed 10 items of identity theft. It is not 10 separate incidents.
Okay. Just one more. Class B felony, what's the...
That is a 10-year potential prison term. The senator and the members of the committee should note that I have, as a part of this, we have requested that it be designated on the sentencing guidelines grid as a level 8 offense. Thank you. For those of you who aren't aware, I have about a 30-second explanation of the Oregon sentencing guidelines grid, which is this colorful chart that is updated every year, wherein every felon to be sentenced in the state of Oregon is assigned a criminal history score based on, as one might expect, their criminal history, and a crime seriousness score. Then working like a mileage chart, Portland to Salem, which I found is more than an hour. My apologies for being a little late this morning. Usually, 55 miles. Well, where this works is this offender with this history, this level of crime, the presumptive sentence is in that grid block. And what a level 8 offense would do is put a person with this offense in a presumptive grid block of level 8, which is for serious offenders and calls for a presumptive penitentiary term. Now, for repeat property offenders, that is usually going to be in the neighborhood of a presumptive sentence of 21 to 26 months. Repeat property offenders now, if they qualify under the statute, would be looking at a presumptive sentence of 13 months.
Thank you.
That's without any departures. And I could go on for a lot longer about sentencing guidelines, members of the committee, but you
please,
don't want to hear that.
Please don't.
Senator Farrell. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I was intrigued by Senator Ringo's questioning about the 10 instances. It seems to me that in Oregon racketeering statutes, you only need 3 related instances.
Two predicate instances.
And I guess I wondered if these are 9 incidences in 182 days, for instance, would invalidate this approach, or would it be if an identity thief only strikes twice in a year and there are only 9 instances on either side of the 180-day period, how does that figure in? I mean, there's a time limit and a number of predicate instances, and I'm wondering how those were chosen.
Senator, members of the committee, the numbers, as I told you, there was a discussion about the number, that is 10. The 180-day period was chosen because there already exist, under Oregon law, provisions for the aggregation of theft incidents against a single victim over a 180-day period. That's how that time frame was generated. It is lifted, as we lawyers often do, from a pre-existing tried and true section of the law and grafted into this. There is no magic about that number. It simply was the pre-existing statute. The hypothetical you pose of 9 instances in 172 days would not qualify under this statute unless the person qualified under the either of the other legs, 2 prior identity theft convictions, or the aggregate value was $10,000 or more. They would have to be looked at in a different way.
Well, I guess, Mr. Chairman, if yes. I could follow, then if the if a first offender participated in less than the requisite number, of what would they be prosecuted and convicted eventually? And if there were fewer than, would they ever get an identity theft charge to trigger the
yes.
provisions of the statute? They
yes.
would be charged with it.
Yes. This has no effect on the existing identity theft statute, which would allow the prosecution of a person for their first incident if they fit the elements of the identity theft statute. And were they to be convicted of that crime, then they would go toward qualification under the second leg.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the concluding question. So this, in fact, would be a method of aggregating charges and increasing the penalties for someone engaged in a systematic or programmatic identity theft.
Senator, members of the committee, I think that's a very good summary.
All right. Any other questions? Senator Brady.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I read subsection C of section 1, a person could get this aggravated identity theft charge in a Class B felony for an amount of $10,000, whether it be for a single incident or cumulative incidents. My question is there anywhere else in the statutes not involving personal damage, like robbery or burglary, is there any place else in the statutes where a $10,000 crime will get you a B felony?
Senator Burdick, members of the committee, yes. The aggravated theft statute, aggravated theft in the first degree, ORS 164.057, also has a $10,000 limit. Anything over $10,000 is an aggravated theft in the first degree, and that may be achieved by aggregation as well over a period.
So what is an aggravated theft? Can you give an example?
An aggravated theft is any taking of the property of another, either by deception or any number of means, and the value of the property is over $10,000, with the exception of personal use automobiles. Those are carved out. So if, Senator, someone were to break into someone's home, and it's probably a bad example because that's a burglary, but and in the course of that take the jewelry collection that's worth $20,000, they could as well be charged with theft in the first degree along with the burglary in the first degree.
Mr. Chairman, I presume that's where you got this $10,000 figure from, that part of the statute.
Senator, that's correct.
And do you happen to know when the last time that $10,000 was looked at as a threshold?
Senator, I was, as I drove down here this morning, I was trying to remember when it was that I proposed that to the legislature, and I believe it was either in 1985 or 1987. I think it was probably 1987. At that time, there were only 2 levels of theft in the state of Oregon. There was theft in the first degree, theft in the second degree. At that time, the distinction between those was $200. If any theft you committed was a Class C felony, if it was $200 or more. I came down to the legislature and made the suggestion that we include the most serious offenders as a B felony and also reduce the level of responsibility for the low-end offenders, and that's the genesis of our current hierarchy of theft offenses, where theft in the third degree is any taking of $50, less than $50. Then theft in the second degree is from $50 to $750, and aggravated theft, theft in the first degree is from $750 to $10,000, and then aggravated theft is from $10,000 and up.
Thank you for the history lesson.
All right. History is good sometimes. I do have a couple of questions myself, and we're using on lines 18 and 19 the comparable offense language. How is that generally determined, or how would you?
Sorry, Senator, I don't have a one with a numbered.
I'm sorry. It says it's subsection 4, sub B, a conviction entered in any other state or federal court for identity theft or a comparable offense.
Yes.
It's the definition comparable offense. How's that determined?
Well, it would be on a case by case basis, Senator, members of the committee. Comparable offense language is also used elsewhere in the Oregon Criminal Code. It is used in the repeat property offender statute at ORS 137.717. I do not believe that it has there is any decisional case law that has been generated out of that. It is fought on a day-to-day basis in the courtrooms across the state.
Now, is that something that would generally be determined at the time of charging indictment? It's not necessarily something you argue in court in front of a judge or jury with respect to this particular charge. Would it be pretrial motions to dismiss, et cetera?
Senator, members of the committee, typically in making such a charge, we would have to identify at the time of charging whether or not this person has the requisite pre-existing convictions. And so that is done as quickly as possible. Part of the practice in Multnomah County is to do a criminal history. The Portland Police Bureau submits to us the printouts, and our criminal history folks do their best to get a criminal history to us as soon as possible. We rely on those. Typically, we go to grand jury within 5 days of arrest. So once it's determined that we believe that there are the prerequisite convictions, then the defense would be able to challenge the existence of those. That could be done either at sentencing, or I think that it could conceivably be raised at trial, whether or not this is an element of the offense or this is for sentencing. But I think it could be raised pretrial.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Mr. Callahan, thank you. Appreciate it.
Chair, members of the committee, thank you.
For the record, Oregon Council of Police Associations does not want to testify on the bill, but wants to be noted in the record that they do support Senate 52. Susan Russell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'm here today to speak in opposition to Senate Bill 52 as it is currently drafted. By creating the crime of aggravated identity theft, there are a number of problems with Senate Bill 52 because it is based on the pre-existing identity theft statute. Identity theft is an extremely broad crime. It is committed any time a person obtains, possesses, transfers, creates, utters, or converts to the person's own use the personal identification of another person with the intent to deceive or defraud. Identity theft encompasses conduct which is often covered by a number of other statutes. These can include giving false information to a police officer, theft, forgery, criminal possession of a forged instrument, fraudulent use of a credit card, computer crime, filing a false police report, and criminal impersonation. Because aggravated identity theft relies on the same terms and definitions used in the identity theft statute, it suffers from the same problems as identity theft. And these problems stem from the statute's overbroadness, I think in particular in three ways. First of all, identity theft covers an intent to deceive as well as an intent to defraud. There is no requirement that the identity deception cause harm, that it be intended to cause harm, or even that there is a threat of harm. Secondly, the definition of personal identification under the identity theft statute includes both real and imaginary persons. And by including imaginary persons...
Could you speak up?
I'm sorry. Sure.
Getting older, a little harder hearing, so...
By including both real and imaginary persons, this identity theft statute can give rise to a number of circumstances that are really far-reaching, and I'll give some examples in a minute. And finally, the definition of personal identification includes a broad number of pieces of information. It includes common matters as common as name, address, telephone number, date of birth, and place of employment, in addition to more financial matters. The following examples would constitute identity theft under the present statute. A prosecutor uses a fictitious name for a telephone listing so that defendants cannot attain his home number and call him at home. A victim of domestic violence uses a false name when renting an apartment so that her abusive husband cannot find her.
Mr. Chair?
I just really want to track what you're saying. If somebody uses a false name in, say, an application for an apartment, why is that identity theft?
Because they are uttering through written document a false name with the intent to deceive.
Thank you. Madam Chair,
just to follow up on that, where's the intent to defraud?
It's either intent to deceive or defraud.
Mm-hmm. But isn't there a criminal intent requirement? Wouldn't there the burden of proof be on a prosecutor to show that there was a criminal intention?
Mr. Senator, yes, there is a requirement the state prove, but because the statute is broadly defined, the state must prove one of two things. Either that the defendant intends to deceive or that the defendant intends to defraud. Our concern is that by including intend to deceive as an alternative, there may be no intent to defraud, there may be no risk of financial loss, it may not even be the person's objective, but yet they would fall within the identity theft and potentially aggravated identity theft if it is building on this provision.
Madam Chairman, follow up. It's my understanding in Oregon statute currently that there is no crime if a person uses an alias for purposes not intended, without criminal intent.
And Senator Ferriola, in this statute, identity theft, the criminal intent is an intent to deceive. So, for example, I'm sure there are circumstances when somebody could use a name without an intent to deceive, but in those kind of examples, there would be an intent to deceive. For example, if a student went downstairs and ordered a copy of a pending bill and wrote down on the document their name was Cinderella for no other reason, it's an intent to deceive, let's say, that could be an identity theft. If the state proved that there was an intent to deceive, that they were not the person that they represented, it could be identity theft.
Madam Chairman, I think that stretches the imagination a little bit. I guess I was thinking more of a case where in the occupation of telephone solicitation, you know, where not my favorite classification of employer, but often people use a name that is not their own name. And there is no intent to deceive or intent to defraud. It's simply used in customer service situations for the same discussion we heard earlier. It prevents stalking issues. People often don't want to be contacted in other settings. And currently that's not a crime in Oregon. I guess I need to ask this witness if this statute would criminalize that behavior, in your opinion. And would it likely be prosecuted, in your opinion?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrell, I can't comment on whether it would be prosecuted. That depends on counties and the specific circumstances. In my opinion, because the identity theft statute includes this intent to deceive in addition to intent to defraud, it is possible, depending on the circumstances, where somebody intends to deceive in that circumstance, but does not intend to do so for any purpose to cause a loss or to defraud or a financial loss, that it is possible under those circumstances that somebody could fall foul of the identity theft statute, and that there is no reason for the intent to deceive. There's no conduct that is encompassed within the intent to deceive that is not encompassed with the intent to defraud, and that is the intent to defraud that really is the problem. We're talking about identity theft. We're talking about the circumstances where the victim is a real person and the defendant attempts or actually obtains credit or other financial matters of value from the victim. That's really what identity theft should be addressing, and by being overly broad in the terms used, it goes more far afield than that. And that is our primary concern with identity theft on both with this bill. I would point out that there are a couple other bills that are pending that also address the identity theft. One, when you mentioned earlier the racketeering statute, one of the pending bills would make identity theft a predicate act under the Racketeering Act. And there is an additional bill which would expand identity theft to include not only written representations, which it is currently limited to, but to include also verbal acts. So there are a number of possibilities if either of those bills move forward to imagine even more egregious circumstances that could fall afoul.
Question here from Council Prince.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Senator Farrioli, I wanted to make a clarification on the, I think your question was on an oral question on a tele, I don't know what you call it, a
telemarketer.
That currently, my belief, I prosecuted these cases, you could not prosecute that under the current law or under this bill because it would need to be written, a written uttering of an identification. I also wanted to, as a bit of history, the intent was added to deceive last session. That was added because of situations where the deception was not for financial gain. The most common situation we see that would be if a person has a warrant out and gets stopped by the police, uses the name Senator Ted Farrioli. That's not to gain financial, you know, to do any financial harm, but it is used to deceive. So that was, I think, the main thrust of why it was expanded last session.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the point of my question was whether or not this bill criminalizes a representation, any representation. It was sort of a yes or no kind of answer I was after. Mr. Chairman, I guess I have another question after listening to this witness. If there are so many bills headed this direction, Madam Chairman, what's the prospect of getting all of them at once and looking at an omnibus approach rather than piecemeal approach?
That's a very interesting point. So I was just jotting a note to the real actual chairman here, thinking along those same lines. And along those same lines, before I get to Senator Ringo, I just wanted to ask you, it seems like your basic problem is with the underlying statute and the vagueness of it. And I'm just, I think you got to this by mentioning the other bills, but would it, if this aggravated piece could be narrowed down or focused in some ways, would some of those concerns disappear?
Madam Vice Chair, that's correct. I think that's a fair statement in summary of our position and concerns.
So it seems like we might have a couple of choices to, you know, to think of narrowing it or maybe broadening it out to do a more thorough discussion. Senator Ringo?
Thank you. I mean, just I am concerned about the possibility of this intent to deceive in a way that doesn't cause financial harm. And it sounds like there's lots of potential examples, whether people filling out employment applications or applications to rent an apartment, that where they've got deceiving information on their application, they're not causing anybody financial harm. And when I look at the bill, I would feel a lot better about this bill if we deleted subsection A. Because let's say there were 10 acts, but they were all pretty minor, I wouldn't want that to be a Class B felony. Subsection B, I have no problem with that. Two previous convictions, and yet they're still committing these kinds of crimes. They ought to be hammered. Subsection C causes damages of more than $10,000. I don't have any problem with that either. They ought to be hammered. But I don't want to see a situation where somebody commits a number of small acts that don't cause any financial harm, and yet are being prosecuted for a Class B felony. So those are just my comments, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any further questions, this witness?
Let me ask a question.
Mr.
The word intent has a specific legal meaning in criminal law. Isn't that a fairly high threshold prosecutors have to rise to in terms of proving their case?
Senator Minnis, it depends on the circumstances. How difficult it is to prove would depend how far somebody has proceeded in an act. I think giving an example with respect to the intent to deceive, when somebody fills out, a woman who's fleeing from her husband fills out a hotel application for one night and writes down a name that she knows is false with the conscious objective that she not be known by her true name, would not be something that would be difficult to prove that her intent was to use a name that she knew not to be her own. There may be circumstances where it's more difficult to prove intent.
All right. Are you aware of any cases where that's been prosecuted, that kind of scenario?
And I don't know one way or the other, Senator Minnis.
All right. So, I'm just suggesting there may be something we can talk about here. What you're suggesting is it should be intent to deceive or defraud for criminal purposes? I mean, in other words, you're suggesting that somebody could intend to defraud or to deceive by putting a fictitious name on a motel application to conceal throne.
Correct, Senator Minnis. And I think our thoughts would be that it should be with the intent to cause or attempt to cause a pecuniary loss. It may not be those exact words, but that's the kind of to cause someone or attempt to cause somebody a financial loss or.
I'm trying to get to the point where I don't know that you have to have a financial loss to have a significant impact on a person's life.
And correct, Senator Miss. And that's why I think off the top of my head, what language would encompass that beyond the intent to defraud?
Yeah, I'm thinking of an example where I've arrested people and you take them to jail only to find that the person in the back seat is the brother of the person you really want. Mm-hmm. And the brother, you know, used this other person's name, or you know, they traded names or whatever, and they look alike. Mm-hmm. And I actually had cases where you have twins and they trade names back and forth, but the guy in the back seat is not the person who's wanted. So that's not a financial issue, but it is something that has an issue of liberty involved. Mm-hmm. So there may be some situations of that nature. And perhaps I think in the instance that counsel mentioned where someone has a warrant You have an individual who's trying to deceive the justice system and to conceal their identity, their true identity, from apprehension, and that seems to rise to a level where it would be appropriate, too. So I have no qualms about talking about this further, but...
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, isn't that already furnishing false information? And wouldn't there be a criminal intent of eluding or escaping the warrant? I mean, isn't that already prosecutable under our statutes?
Madam Chairman, there's two separate, I think, crimes you're talking about. There's attempt to elude, which happens in a motor vehicle case. So it would either be eluding in a car or when you see the lights running out of the car. So that's eluding. Furnishing false information, there is such a crime for both traffic situations and criminal situations. As I recall, the state of the law in that, and it is a misdemeanor. It's a Class A misdemeanor. And as I recall, there is in a traffic situation, there's a requirement that the officer warn the person that it's unlawful to give a false name. But I think there is some overlay with that concept. But keep in mind, this is only for situations of a writing. So if you gave a driver's license with a false name on it, that would be identity theft in that same kind of situation of a contact with police, and would also be furnishing false information, but not every situation.
Sure, I'm tracking. I guess the follow-up question then, Chairman, was that would those likely be prosecuted as identity theft, or would they be prosecuted as furnishing false information? And I guess I'm trying to get a handle on what prosecutors would do.
Madam Chairman, Senator Ferriola, when I prosecuted these cases in Multnomah County, our threshold was much higher than that because of the limited amount of resources and because identity theft has become such a pervasive crime. We looked at cases that had a financial loss in most cases. So I never prosecuted a case like that. I think that it was something that I'm sure there are scenarios where you'd want to, if this is a known felon, if there's a case like that, I could see it happening. But the reality from my experience was there's so many of these cases where it's just the garden variety stealing a driver's license and going to the check store and then maybe hitting several. That's what we focused on.
Sure. All right. I'm going to take the gavel back here real quick just because I want to bring this to closure. Andrea Meyer, are you here for this bill or something else? All right. And Mr. Corey, you're not here for this bill.
I'm not here for this bill. Thank you, sir.
All right. I think with that, I have a suggestion that we pull some of these other bills together or try to look at the concepts in total would be helpful. I'm sorry. Tim, did you want to testify? All right. Mr. Martinez.
Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Could I just ask a quick question of our counsel?
Sure.
This says intent to deceive. Does that have to be intent to deceive the person who's... It's not deceive the person whose identity you've stolen. It's to deceive any third person.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, that's correct. I think it would be the utteree, the person you utter it to, as is normally
okay.
Who you'd think of.
So there could be a situation where you might even have the permission of the person whose identity you're using.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ringo, I would never have prosecuted something like that, and I don't believe it would. I don't know that a judge would allow a prosecutor to do that if chosen to. But
I'm just trying to read the statute.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman and Senator Ringo, in reading the statute, it's important to keep in mind. I know that there is prosecutorial discretion that that is used. I think it's possible. Just like it would be possible for someone to prosecute a woman who gives a name Cinderella when ordering copies of a legislative bill, maybe that is possible in a vacuum. But in reality, I can't imagine it being used.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Mr. Martinez.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. As you know, I don't normally volunteer to come to the table unless asked, but this is, identity theft is an issue that the I think all financial institutions in Oregon have worked very hard on this interim. I know the Oregon Bankers Association has been involved with the Portland group headed by a deputy chief of police. We have a financial institution security task force, which is bankers, credit unions, and thrifts. The DMV has had an identity theft task force that continues to meet, and the OBA has an internal task force that is working on this. Financial fraud, identity theft is becoming a huge issue around the country, including Oregon, and the Oregon Bank Association has made a priority for this legislative session to try to put in place some measures to reduce the amount of this activity in Oregon. I would also caution the committee that in Washington they will have a package of bills too, and if we don't keep current with what the state of Washington does, it's not very far across that bridge from Vancouver down here to Oregon. So this issue is one of tremendous concern to, I think, all financial institutions. I would be happy and have worked with the chair at various meetings and continue to do so, and if you want to bring them all together on the same day, that would be a great idea. But bills like this, we think, are very critical, and would be very, we would be very supportive.
All right, thank you. And maybe we should pull together some testimony from individuals who investigate these kind of crimes to talk about the kind of cases they're actually dealing with. And I don't work property crimes in the bureau, so I don't have that kind of familiarity. But I do know that they're overwhelmed with work, and their threshold for what gets prosecuted or what gets investigated is pretty high. Maybe we can get some testimony to that effect, too. Okay. All right. Any other questions? Senator Brady.
Just a question to counsel. I guess maybe Mr. Martinez, if he knows, is just where these other bills are in the process. I presume they're House bills that are taking a more comprehensive look at the situation and what, you know, where they are in the process.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Vice Chair, one of the bills that is up, I believe, this week is a truncation of credit card numbers on receipts. Other states have gone down that road. If you go to your local restaurant or watering hole, check your receipts, see whether it has the whole 16 digits on or whether it's just the last four. We think that's an important change to make as well, because that's a huge way to get personal information and to get credit card numbers. So that is in the House. There are a couple other bills in the House as well, and I know at least the OBA is looking at some things in addition.
Mr. Chairman, I guess
yes.
The question I had is whether it would be productive at this point to try to address some of the concerns with this particular bill, or whether it needs a more comprehensive look.
Well, the relating clause is relating to crime, so we can do a lot with this.
Oh, yes,
you got a lot of those really.
A lot of interesting things.
But no, I think the intent would be to try to write a good law that tries to deal with the volume of problems that are being faced by financial institutions. And I think that is an interesting key to some of the examples given have been people that maybe you're trying to hide from their husband or from their engagement in some of their relationship. But I don't think we see those things, so that kind of prosecution, very often. It's not possible you might see one, but it's not, I think, our general experience. So, Tim, thank you.
Thank you. I just close, Mr. Chairman, by letting you know that one of your former colleagues, who happened to be Senate President and runs a bank down in Grants Pass, now sets aside more for financial fraud than he does for loan losses. So that, I think that's becoming more and more of a trend. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. All right. With that, I think we'll, unless there's anyone else wishing to testify, we will conclude the public hearing on Article 52, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 65. And Dina, I think you're up. All right. And there's a police report which is being handed out. The names have been redacted. Just to give you an example of what it is. Colonel Harper refused to come to this meeting. Yes, and Mr. Stonebrink is not going to be present with the Cattlemen's Association either.
Weak stomach?
All right. I think so. Tina, if you would state your name for the record, we'll proceed.
My name is Dina Clark, and I'm here in support of Senate Bill 65. I work for the Courtland Police Bureau and have been assigned to the Sex Crimes Unit as an administrative assistant for 9 years. I was happy to see the legislation that passed last year regarding the sexual abuse of an animal, as we do see this in some of our crime reports. However, in one of our recent cases, it was determined that the new law did not cover the activity described in the report. This report described the person causing the animal to come into contact with the person's genitalia. I'm hoping that the change will be made with Senate Bill 65 to allow for coverage of abuse that occurs in this manner. Although sexual assault of an animal is a topic that most people are uncomfortable talking about, I really feel it needs to be addressed. It seems that oftentimes violence against animals is viewed as a prank. However, it's been shown that it is a strong indicator that the offender has serious issues that need to be addressed to protect both humans and animals. It is our responsibility to recognize these signals and intervene swiftly and effectively. Often the first reports we see are the ones where animals are the victims. Animals are vulnerable and trusting, often seen as easy targets. People who participate in this type of deviant sexual activity and abuse animals will likely assault others who they see as vulnerable, such as children and vulnerable adults. I think it's important to deal with this type of sexual predator as soon as possible. By making this small addition to the law, we would be able to help protect the animals that are abused, and we will also be addressing the problem before it progresses. Animals cannot speak out in defense of themselves, so it is our responsibility and moral obligation to do everything we can to keep them from harm. And in the end, I think this will most likely keep people safer as well. I ask you to make this modification to allow for fuller coverage of the existing law of sexual assault to an animal.
All right. Thank you, Dina. And you've worked in the sexual assault detail for how long?
9 years.
For 9 years. And this was for the committee. She is the TCA.
Administrative assistant
in the detail that I work in, which is adult sex crimes. So, any questions of Ms. Clark? There are no questions. And everybody else sign up for testimony? I don't know. I might have buried it. Is there anyone else here that signed up to testify?
No.
There is none. Dina, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Work session, Senate Bill 65.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move that we recommend approval of Senate Bill 65 and send it to the Senate floor on the consent calendar with Senator Ringo as the carrier with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Burdick.
All right.
I love that motion.
Burdick moves that Senate Bill 65 be adopted, unamended, sent to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation and placed on the consent calendar, and that Senator Ringo be the carrier, unless Senator Ringo objects. Is there any discussion?
I really appreciate the honor.
Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. Thank you very much. Any other business before the committee? We have one LC draft. Is that your introduction or not?
Did we do
work? Oh, yeah, we did. Okay. You're pretty fast.
She never took her out of the box on that one.
That's right.
Your car is not very friendly.
You know, we should probably take her off the consent calendar.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we do have one LC for possible introduction by the committee, LC 2051, which is relating to assault and would amend the Assault 3 statute so that a person who causes injury to a government person enforcing parking regulations would be subject to it.
All right. Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we introduce LC 2051 as a Judiciary Committee bill.
Senator Burdick moves the introduction of LC 2051. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none. So ordered. Any other business before the committee? If not, we're adjourned.
So did some meter reader get...